We're continuing with the messengers of the Advent message. Who were they? We already talked about William Miller and Joseph Bates. There were some other people that sometimes are not even included in our main teaching of Adventist history. One of them is Joseph Wolff, but he is mentioned in the Great Controversy, and he was a tremendous missionary. He's not only a missionary to America or to Africa. He was known to be the missionary to the world. I will read to you the list of countries that he says he went through, just for you to have an idea how wide was his preaching, how wide was the extent of his travels and his work. In 1831, he was sent as a missionary from Great Britain to labor among the Jews of Palestine. Now remember, this man was a Jew who got converted. First, he became a Catholic, then he became Anglican, and then he was sent as a missionary. But above all that, he was preaching about the coming of Jesus. He was announcing to the world that the coming of Jesus was very soon. He proclaimed the Lord's speedy advent in, and then here's the list of countries. Let's just read through them to have an idea of where he went through. Palestine, Egypt, on the shores of the Red Sea, Mesopotamia, which is today's Iraq, the Crimea, you know where that is, the Black Sea, Persia, Georgia, and it's not talking about the state of Georgia, it's the country Georgia. Throughout the Ottoman Empire, remember the Ottoman Empire that we have been looking at? It was alive and almost well, not quite well at that point. It was about to go out, but it was still alive. In Greece, Arabia, Turkey, Bukhara, Afghanistan, Kashmir, Hindustan, Tibet, in Holland, Scotland, Ireland, at Constantinople, Jerusalem, St. Helena, also on shipboard in the Mediterranean, and in New York City, to all denominations. But remember, there was another place that he didn't even mention here, which was in the United States Congress. He actually preached there about the coming of Jesus. Do you understand what that means? It meant that God was telling the whole world through his people, through his chosen agents, he was telling the whole world that Christ was soon coming. So when you announce something to the legislative body of the country, that is a big thing. And he was invited to speak at Congress, and he preached there that Jesus was coming soon. He declares that he has preached among Jews, Turks, Mohammedans, Parsis, Hindus, Chaldeans, Yazidis, Syrians, Sabaeans, Tupashas sheikhs, Shahs, the kings of Organst and Bukhara, the Queen of Greece, etc. In Yemen, the region inhabited by the descendants of Hobab, Moses' father-in-law, Joseph Wolff saw a book which he thus speaks. The Arabs of this place have a book called Sirah, which treats of the second coming of Christ and his reign in glory. And that's from his mission to the Bukhara book, or to Bukhara. Try to get the import of this. Rereading the Bible about Moses. He was the first author in the Bible. Is that right? He wrote the first few books. In there, we read of Moses' father-in-law, Hobab. And now, how many thousand years later? 3,500 years later, here comes a missionary to Yemen, and he finds those same people that Moses talked about, the descendants of Hobab. How amazing is that? And they have a book called Sirah, which talk about the speedy coming of Christ, the coming of Christ in His glory, the second coming. So they knew, and many people knew that Christ was coming a second time. In Yemen, he spent 6 days with the Rechabites. Now, we move forward here to the future, after the time of Moses, maybe 700 years after Moses. And the Bible talks about the Rechabites. You remember that, right? We already talked about it. When they were still keeping the command of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, that they should not drink wine, that they should inhabit tents and plant no vineyards. And look what Loughborough says regarding Joseph Wolfe. He says, in Yemen, he spent 6 days with the Rechabites, of whom he says, they drink no wine, plant no vineyards, sow no seed, live in tents, and remember the words of Jonadab, the son of Rechab. With them were the children of Israel, of the tribe of Dan, who reside near Tarim in Hadramat, who expect in common with the children of Rechab the speedy arrival of the Messiah in the clouds of heaven. Were they expecting His first coming? No. They are Israelites of the tribe of Dan, and they expect the second coming of Christ in the clouds of heaven. That, for me, is so amazing. We see from the above that in those 14 years, Wolfe himself had proclaimed the news of Christ's coming at the doors in more than 20 different nations. During the same time, the doctrine was extensively agitated in Germany, particularly in the south among the Moravians. So here you have a few illustrations of how he was going about, you know, with the Arabs there on the left. In the center, you have the title page of his book. This is actually the book he wrote. The Travels and Adventures of the Reverend Joseph Wolfe. And it is amazing. If you read Great Controversy, she cites the travels and the experience he had. And Loughborough also does that. So it's an amazing person. And he was preaching around the world at the same time that Miller was preaching. You understand, Miller was preaching to the United States. There were other people around the world preaching the same message. Another person here, another of the messengers, Josiah Litch. He read Miller's lectures, published in 1836, and was convicted of Miller's position, but resisted impression to preach it in case it did not come to pass. So he was, as we would say, a little careful, right? Maybe too careful, because he was convicted. He had a dream that persuaded him to be willing to bear reproach for Christ, and began preaching and writing about the doctrine. He's considered to be the first well-known minister to take up Millerite teaching, and first to join Miller in his work, because Himes was in 1839, and Charles Fitch only joined in 1841. He wrote an article in June entitled The Probability of the Second Coming of Christ about AD 1843, predicting the fall of the Ottoman Empire based on Revelation 9, awakening much interest in the northeastern part of the United States. This was Josiah Litch. In Great Controversy, you also read about him. And as we saw already, he was the one that predicted that the Ottoman Empire would fall. In what day? We must remember this. August 11, 1840. Remember that? It was after the 391 years and 15 days. We must remember that. Those are special prophecies that help us to understand where we are. August 11, 1840 is when he understood that the Ottoman Empire would fall, and it happened exactly like the prediction said. And in Great Controversy, Ellen White calls this a remarkable fulfillment of prophecy. She says, in the year 1840, another remarkable fulfillment of prophecy took place or happened. Another person here, we have Joshua Himes. This was considered to be the publisher of William Miller because he was a minister, but he had a great talent in publishing. And he was a go, go, go person. He was a reformer. He espoused the causes such as abolitionism, that means anti-slavery, pacifism, education, and temperance. He attended Miller's lectures on the Charlton Street in Boston, the church there. These were Miller's first lectures in a major city, given twice a day. The interest was so great that hundreds had to be turned away. After Miller's lectures, Himes met with Miller and joined him in the cause as its prime mover, opening doors to other Christian churches in the large cities and editing and publishing. Francis de Nicol described his method as action and on a large scale and without delay. So that's how Himes was. It's interesting to see the way he met Miller and joined him. Miller preached and he was convicted by Miller's preaching. Then he comes to Miller, I don't know if it was right after the service or he invited Miller to go home to speak to him. And he said, Mr. Miller, do you really believe what you preach? What you're teaching us? And Miller said, of course I believe, otherwise I wouldn't be teaching it. And he said, what are you doing to spread this to the world? And Miller responded, I'm doing all I can. I need help. I ask for help, but nobody's helping. Then we're told that Joshua Himes said, prepare the campaign. We will enter into every major city of the United States. And in fact, that's about what they did. They went everywhere preaching and entering major cities like Boston, New York, you know, and other cities. So Miller was the person that was teaching, but the main person behind all the publishing, which exponentially grew the message, the extent of the message, was Joshua Himes. In 1839, he became a convert to the Advent cause, as expounded by the famous elder William Miller. He entered the new cause with all the enthusiasm he possessed, and his ministrations were full of fire and power. In 1840, he began the publication of The Signs of the Times. Is that familiar? It's amazing. We still have it today. He was the person who published that magazine the first. Then when that was done, another of the Adventist people started or restarted its publications. But Joshua Himes was the one that probably coined the name, not invented the name, but coined the name for a magazine. Because the Signs of the Times, the word appears in the Bible, right? So he didn't invent that, but to use it in the magazine, I think he was the first one to do that. So he began in 1840 the publication of the Signs of the Times, advocating the cause into which he had thrown his whole heart. All his money, all his labor, all his energy were thrown into the lap of this cause. Just like Joseph Bates, as we read yesterday, remember? As we saw yesterday. Joseph Bates spent all his money to the point of saying, this was the last money I had on earth when he bought the 4 pounds of flour. So Joshua Himes did exactly the same thing. He spent all his money into this cause and thousands of converts were won. The great physical force of Elder Himes preserved him till he entered his 92nd year. And I wanted to pay attention to this thing that I'll mention next. Quite amazing. His faculties of mind were vigorous to the last. In the year 1894, how many years after the disappointment? 50 years later, right? 50 years after, he gave a most stirring discourse to a congregation of over 3,000 Seventh-day Adventists on the campground in Lansing, Michigan. He seemed to speak with much of the earnestness and vigor of olden days. 50 years later, he's speaking to a congregation of Seventh-day Adventists. 3,000 people, and very excited about it, just 2 years before he died. He published this. Have you seen this? The Millennial Harp? This was the hymn book of the Millerites, published in 1843. Look at this. Millennial Harp, designed for meetings on the Second Coming of Christ, improved edition. Three parts in one volume, Boston, 1843, published by Joshua Himes. If you see the hymns that are found here, oh, you feel so touched. Some are being sung now. We have some of these in our hymn books, and some are not. But you should take a look. There's one that's called, Lo, what a glorious sight appears. And you can imagine what it is. They were expecting the coming of Christ, and it was so powerful, so touching. Here's a depiction of the tent in which Miller would preach. They called it the Great Tent, and it was very great. They said it held about 7,000 people inside. So it was a big tent. But it would be so full, so packed, that people wouldn't be able to stay inside. They had overflow, not rooms, but trees, right? So they would hang a chart on the trees and teach out of the chart, because inside it was too packed. And people would just flock there. Another person that was very prominent, probably the most prominent one that joined Miller and Himes, was Charles Fitch. He was a very well-known minister. If you read, I think it's in early writings, Ellen White mentions Brother Fitch and Stockman. Remember? She's talking about him. She has a vision. And I'll mention the vision later on. Remind me, okay? At the point there he dies. It's related to his death. He was the one that, along with Apollos Hale, published the 1843 chart. He says, "Mr. Miller, I have never seen, but his writings have greatly enlightened my mind, for which I give God thanks, hoping that others may hereby be induced to read and be, as I have been, greatly profited. Yours in the blessed hope of Christ's glorious appearing, Charles Fitch." That was a letter to Josiah Litch. He prepared the chart with Apollos Hale, 1843 chart. He preached and published a sermon that says, "Come out of her, my people." You can listen to this sermon, not his voice, but the writings, and then somebody recorded the sermon. Just go to lnyaudio.org and scroll down all the way to the section where you find the Pioneers audiobooks. It's after Ellen White's audiobooks. Then you will see this. You will see that sermon there. He was chilled, very much chilled. The whole body was cold while he was baptizing converts, and he became seriously ill. So ill that he died a few days later. He died on, look at the date, October 14, 1844. What does that mean? 8 days, I'm sorry, before the disappointment. And we're told that his wife told the children not to cry for daddy because they would see him soon. That's a sobering thought, right? They were really expecting Christ to come. It was with all their hearts. So we would think, oh, that's a disaster, you know, it's so sad. The children, but wait, there's a promise. In early writings, Ellen White says that as the saved were gathering together there in heaven and were meeting, they met Brother Fitch and Stockman. So he will be one of the saved in heaven. He will be with us. He's not there yet, but he will be there when Jesus resurrects all his people. And then she says that Brother Fitch and Stockman asked the Advent group, what happened after they died? What were the difficulties, you know, the tribulations that they passed through? And she says that the group couldn't remember. And then she says, heaven is cheap enough. Heaven is cheap enough. Remember that. And the Bible passage that he based the chart on was Habakkuk chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. And I'll read to you here. It says, I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower, and I will watch to see what he will say unto me and what I shall answer when I am reproved. And the Lord answered me and said, write the vision. Which vision? Well, if we understand that the chart was a fulfillment of that, and Ellen White in Great Controversy cites that or mentions that they understood that it was a fulfillment, she says. They, the authors of the chart, right? So if we take that to mean, so it's talking about the vision of Daniel chapter 8 and 9. Write the vision and make it plain upon tables, that he may run that readeth it. That's a speech figure, right? It's kind of explaining what it would mean. It's saying the person may be running and will still understand because it's so clear. And look at that. The dates, you know, it's clear. You have the statue, you have the animals of chapter 7 and then chapter 8. You have the death of Christ. You have Babylon, you have the Ottoman Empire, you have the woes. It's amazing how it is. Now, there are some things that are not there in the chart, so it's not perfect. And there are some mistakes as well. One thing that is not there is the third angel's message. Right? Another thing, the 2520 is there, but that's a mistake. And we will see let's take a look now. Here's the 1843 chart on the left. On the center, you have the 1850 chart. And in 1863, James White made a new chart because the previous ones were exhausted. There was no more. So they had to make a new chart. And in the same meetings when the church was established, they asked James White, or when the church was organized, they asked James White to make a new chart. So, as organized church, we never taught 2520. Never. When the church was organized, we were working on something else. And he even had to explain why he took it out, because apparently people were doing back then the same they're doing today, holding on to the 2520, right? If we take a close look at the charts, we will see that 2520 is very prominent in the first chart, 1843. In the second chart, 1850, it is very small, almost disappearing. It's on its way out. And in 1863, it's completely out, it's absent. People say that Ellen White endorsed the first chart and therefore the 2520 must be true, but she also endorsed the second chart. And she also endorsed the third chart. So, to take one statement and enlarge it and make it mean what it doesn't mean is not right. It's a fallacy, right? Look what she says regarding the 1863 chart. People will criticize James White today They're criticizing him today because he took out the 25-20. But those are the people that hold on to it. They don't hold on to the Bible, Spirit, Prophecy, or the Pioneers. They hold on to that date. Right? So people criticize James White, but look what Ellen White says of the 1863 chart. She's writing in 1868, 5 years after he made the chart. And look what she says. "And we would say to those who are poor and want books, send in your orders with a statement of your condition as to this world's goods. We will send you a package of books containing 4 volumes of spiritual gifts, How to Live, Appeal to Youth, Appeal to Mothers, Sabbath Readings, and the 2 large charts with key of explanation." This is Testimonies for the Church, Volume 1, page 689. The 2 large charts are the 2 charts that James White made. Let me show you how they were. The first one was with the prophecies, and the second one was with the law of God. She's endorsing these 2 charts. And then in 1870, she writes again regarding these 2 charts. She says, "Are you missionaries in your neighborhoods and in your own families?" And then she shows how to teach the people and to be missionaries in the families, right? She says, "You can hang up the charts and show them," that means the people we're teaching, "and show them the truth as it is there illustrated." Is she saying we can't use the 1863 chart because it doesn't have the 2520? Not at all. She's saying, use this chart and show them the truth as it is there illustrated in the 1863 chart. "You can teach them, if you would have a mind thus to do, by explaining prophetic history," the first chart was about prophecy, "and tracing down prophecies that the end of all things is at hand. You can impress them with the sacredness of the law of God." The second chart was about the law. He made 2 charts. "And show them its claims upon them." Do you see what she's saying? So be careful with the entanglements of the 2520. We come to the next one, the next prominent one. Although he wasn't very prominent at the time of the Millerites, there were much more prominent ministers. But he was preaching with the Millerites. But when the Adventist Church, or after 1844, when the Sabbath started becoming prominent, James White assumed a leadership role that will hardly be matched by anybody in this movement. He was a descendant of Peregrine White, who was the only baby born in the Mayflower. You remembered that. Remember that part? As the Peregrines were coming, as the Pilgrim Fathers were coming to the United States in that boat, the Mayflower, there was one baby born there. His name was Peregrine White. It was like the symbol of liberty, right? A new baby being born in the voyage to liberty. James White was a direct descendant of that boy. James White wanted to be a teacher, but changed his course after hearing William Miller. He first heard Miller preach at a meeting in the Mammoth Tent in Eastern Maine in September 1842 at age 21. He began preaching the Advent message in October 1842, still at age 21. He was young as he was preaching. This picture here is around, I think he was about 60 years of age. But, and that's when he died. He died at age 60 because he overworked. So let's not follow that part of, you know, the example. He died, Jan Andrews died of overwork. And we need to be careful. But I think today we're even more prone to not work at all and to just let the current flow. He began preaching the Midnight Cry message in August 1844. He says, "At the age of 20, I had buried myself in the spirit of study in school teaching, and I had laid down the cross. I loved this world more than I loved Christ and the next, and was worshiping education instead of the God of heaven. His mother's appeal and the witness of friends convicted him of the Advent message. He came under the conviction, similar to William Miller, to share with the students he had taught. After initially rejecting the conviction, he did so. That means he preached it. Then he struggled over what his future should be, wanting still to be a teacher. And James White continues, I finally gave all for Christ and his gospel and found peace and freedom. On returning from the great camp meeting in Eastern Maine, where I heard with deepest interest such men as Miller, Himes, and Preble, I found myself happy in the faith that Christ would come about the year 1843. I had given up all to teach the doctrine to others, and to prepare myself to do this was the great object before me. I had purchased the chart illustrating the prophecies of Daniel and John, used by lecturers at that time, and had a good assortment of publications upon the matter, object, and time of the Second Advent. And with this chart hung before me and these books and the Bible in my hands, I spent several weeks in close study, which gave me a clear view of the subject. And here he describes his disappointment. You will see, I will begin reading from the middle here, the part that says the love of Jesus. The love of Jesus filled every soul and beamed from every face. And with inexpressible desires, they prayed, Come, Lord Jesus, and come quickly. But he did not come. And now to turn again to the cares, perplexities, and dangers of life, in full view of the jeers and revilings of unbelievers who now scoffed as never before, was a terrible trial of faith and patience. When Elder Himes visited Portland, Maine, a few days after the passing of the time, and stated that the brethren should prepare for another cold winter, my feelings were almost uncontrollable. I left the place of meeting and wept like a child. I don't think we even understand a little bit of how terrible it was for them. And then the last person we'll mention here is Samuel Snow. He was the man who understood the exact day of the end of the 2300 days. Miller didn't understand the exact date. He understood that it was sometime in October. And this was after the first disappointment. They had already had a first disappointment, but when before the second one came, they didn't know exactly the date, but we're told that in the month of August, they had a meeting, a camp meeting, in this place here, Exeter, New Hampshire. And they were studying the Bible and trying to understand what would happen. When was Christ coming? When was the date? And Joseph Bates was preaching, and Samuel Snow comes by horse. And as he comes into the room where Joseph Bates was preaching, he speaks to a lady in the back. And this lady raises her hand and says, what you're saying, preacher, is something that we already studied before. Here's a man with new light. And Joseph Bates willingly said, come forward, brother. And he sat down and let Samuel Snow preach. Can you believe that? What humility that is? Then he announced to the people that the coming of Jesus would happen on the 10th day of the 7th month. In the 10th day of the 7th month, using the correct Jewish counting, not the rabbinical, but the correct Jewish counting, was October 22, 1844. From that point, they went all over the United States by trains, by horse, by buggy, on foot, and they were preaching to the whole people around. The bridegroom cometh, go ye out to meet him. And Ellen White, in Great Controversy, states that that was the midnight cry. Remember the parable that Jesus taught about the virgins, the 10 virgins? The parable says that at midnight, there was a cry. Behold, the bridegroom cometh. Go ye out to meet him. That exactly fulfilled this part of the teaching of Jesus. The midnight cry. And that marked the... That was the first light in Ellen White's vision of the narrow way. She says that there was a light that illuminated their feet coming from the back. And she says that was the midnight cry. Anybody that denied the midnight cry lost their way and would fall to the world. So we will end with this, and tomorrow we will look at the message itself.